Wessex Press, an imprint of Gazagine Books, is a premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. They are also our publishers for The One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, A New Generation on Sherlock Holmes. It was edited by several of the Baker Street Babes and contains a foreword by Laurie R. King, the author of the Mary Russell series. Another brilliant book published with Gazagine Books is Matthias Boström and Matt Laffey's Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle in the Newspapers. If you'd like to know more about Wessex Press, Gazagine Books, or our publication, please go to www.wessexpress.com.
The Baker Street Journal is a leading Sherlockian publication written by the readers for the readers. It contains both academic articles and light, fun reading for any sort of Sherlock Holmes enthusiast. If you are a fan of The Great Detective and the other works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and you'd like to read new and exciting writings by Sherlockians, or even find information on how to get published in the journal, please visit their website, www.bakerstreetjournal.com.
This episode of the Baker Street Babes podcast is brought to you by Sherlock Unraveled, your source for almost all the information on the clothing and props featured in the BBC show Sherlock, as well as some of the clothes favored by the stars themselves. Check out SherlockUnraveled.com now for the latest costumes from Series 4. If you would like to sponsor an episode of the Baker Street Babes podcast, please get in touch at curly@bakerstreetbabes.com.
They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street Babes always leave the rest of them behind. So in Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two-to-one be mine?
So, controversial episode.
It was something else, that's for sure. Although I did like how it started out, because I think it was one of the only redeeming things about this entire episode. Mrs. Hudson,
yes,
who's driving like she is on the Fast and the Furious, kidnapping Sherlock, handcuffs, like... Like, damn,
she was so good in this,
and her sass was just amazing when she's just, they're like, do you realize how fast you were going? She's like, oh, of course, I was on the phone with the government. Here,
on the phone, hold this phone, the government is still on it.
It was arsenic levels of sass, definitely. It was vitriol throwing levels of sass.
I loved it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'll go on.
And I would like Amy to talk about what she did like about it.
Yes.
Because I know that Amy had like a initial reaction of like, oh yeah, that was like really, really interesting.
Yeah,
and
I like this episode a lot.
I want to hear that reaction.
Yes.
And like, and then there might be other counterpoint.
But also, Amy White, because, I mean, I think Lindsay and I, we both had very similar reactions to this, so it's, I think it's going to be good for us to hear a more positive outlook.
Yes, exactly. So, Amy, help us.
Okay. And, I mean, honestly, I think it's more interesting for people listening if we don't all have the exact same opinion, so, I mean, that's a good thing. And, I mean, obviously, it's very subjective. Initially, what I was... initially very happy with is that we returned back to a Sherlock Holmes in 221B. We have a deductive format. We get very quickly into Sherlock working on a case. We're not still in some kind of out of format kind of thing. We kind of jump back into our format. Obviously, we have things like wondering what's real, what's not real, because we have the appearance of Sherlock being back on drugs, that kind of thing. We also have an appearance by Billy Wiggins, who is a character that I really enjoy, who kind of represents...
Yeah, he's fun. It was multiple, nice to see him again.
Multiple characters. I really like the lying detective as a... I mean, the dying detective as a story. So now I'm going to be confused. I keep, when I'm trying to type the lying detective, I keep typing it as the dying. Also, as a big fan of Toby Jones, I find his performances very charismatic. So I enjoyed that he, as a villain, got a lot of screen time and got a lot of development. It wasn't like one of my big complaints about the Six Thatchers is that we really had this self-contained situation where everybody's creating their own problems, kind of. I like it when we have mysteries we're solving that contain someone else's issue and have a villain that's not not Moriarty and not someone who's involved in our own circle. I enjoy kind of the deductive process. Obviously, we can talk as we go about the issues. Not my favorite thing, the fact that we have the reveal about who this person is who's originally giving Sherlock all this information. Mm-hmm. However, mm-hmm. I liked how it was telegraphed. I think it was intentionally obvious that what we're seeing, there's something wrong with it. Oh, now I heard myself echoing on that. That was weird.
Sorry, that was me.
No, that's okay. I just wanted to make sure.
I think me. I have my microphone set up so that it actually works.
Ooh, oh, good.
That was
hi, Sarah.
Hello,
almost
Sarah.
Entirely.
Yay.
Sarah. Hi. So, I mean, I don't want to just talk for 30 minutes, but just I enjoyed the fact that we had, I actually like the fact that we have, this is not something I normally like, but I like that we had Mary Watson showing up, something that I wasn't expecting. I actually
met Abington again, and it was great.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought that the whole emotional arc between John and Mary in this episode, in my opinion, essentially made much of the last episode unnecessary. And I realize that will be a controversial statement. But I felt that they covered a lot more ground, and it was, to me, just as a general comment, the writing was much more genuine. I was much more emotionally invested in it. Not every single thing. I'm sure
in that relationship, in the John Watson and
yes,
Mary
yes,
Watson relationship.
Yes, absolutely, yes. And I like that we have, basically, I like that it wasn't too neatly tied up, in the sense that we have an admission of the fact that he, at least in his own mind, has been cheating, mm-hmm. and a look at, okay, what was the extent of that, what was not the extent of that, and there's really, when someone passes, there's no, accepting at this point that she has permanently passed. I know there are people who are not going to accept that until the bitter end, but accepting her as a character who has passed, there are things, loose ends that you never get tied up, and you do end up just having to accept those. And I enjoyed the treatment of that, and the fact that, again, that wasn't the whole episode. We had an actual serial killer that we're catching alongside that. Hugely like the fact that Culverton Smith is basically based on H.H. Holmes. The
that
subject
historically was very interesting, because mm-hmm. If people don't have context for that, during the Chicago World's Fair, H.H. Holmes was a serial killer who essentially built a hotel just to murder people. And that's definitely paraphrasing, but that's essentially what happened.
Right. And he was extremely successful. They think it was in the hundreds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, he did a great job.
There's a through line in this that
there's this amazing book about it.
Yes.
By Eric Larson.
Right? Yes. The Devil in the White City. Yeah. It's great.
So if you want to read about H.H. Holmes, that's where you need to go. Right.
And I like the fact that it deals with the concept of what could you get away with if you had enough money and enough popularity. And that's actually, if you do know about H.H. Holmes, that's sort of how he got away with it, was his standing in the community and his own personal charm and popularity. So okay. As a takeoff of him, it actually works really well. I do realize that's not going to land for everybody, because if you don't have knowledge of that person, that parallel's not as like punchy.
Can I just take a tiny bit of exception, not to what you're saying, but to the idea of using H.H. Holmes as this, you know, sort of plot device in the first place. you don't have to bother creating a backstory for a murderer if they're just a serial killer. You don't have to make it make sense. You can just make them, okay, this is an evil person, and this person is just so, so, so bad that they want to kill all kinds of innocent people. And it's not that that doesn't ever happen in the universe, but it's a little bit harder work to come up with something like, let's say, for example, the Boscombe Valley mystery, right? Mm-hmm. Where there are people who actually have a history together. And the reason the terrible crime happened was because something actually mattered to someone, as opposed to I'm just evil. And I was about to say Darth Vader, but then I stopped myself. Even Darth Vader
has a concept.
Even Darth Vader has this whole past that makes it make sense, you know? Mm-hmm. And you have to bother to sit down and write that.
Well, and I mean, if you're looking back at, like, the cabbie, even in Study in Pink, you've got more of an understandable
motivation.
And I mean, I would agree with that. I mean, it is one way that the story does diverge from the dying detective, because obviously in that story, the guy...
He killed his nephew, right?
He kills his nephew, yeah. And then he attempts to kill Holmes, but it's only because Holmes discovers that he killed his nephew. So there's
exactly.
more
so
of
it's a it's a vengeance.
There's a motivation thing. I mean, that probably the number one thing, I promise I'll be quiet in a minute, but probably the number one thing I enjoyed about
it
was
need to be quiet.
Oh, nice. Was the direct parallels, so many direct parallels to The Dying Detective. Like the fact that in that story, the confession is actually personally overheard by Watson, whereas in this situation, we have it being quote unquote overheard by an emblem of Watson.
Mm-hmm. But why would you take that character out of the equation in that way? Like, why, in what manner is that stronger storytelling? Why would a cane as an emblem for Watson be better than Watson actually defending his closest friend?
I don't think it's better, but I don't mind it. But it's, for me, that's a neutral change. And I understand that being a problem for people. For me, it just personally is not a problem. I think because of where they are in their relationship, and I know we'll get into like strong feelings on that, but I think that also, I like the fact that we still have, you know, kind of the fact that Holmes is to some extent faking it out. He's using saline instead of what this guy thinks he's using. Well, for me,
it was a lot of it. And
I'm only speaking specifically at this point about him goading Smith into giving him more of something that isn't the something that Smith thinks he's giving him. That's all I'm saying, right, as a parallel to the fact that in the Dying Detective,
oh, yes, absolutely.
Smith,
oh, sure,
thinks
no,
that he's been poisoned with something. I'm not, yes, talking about the overall context of the drug use. To be perfectly honest, they had originally said that they were not going to bring the addiction, the drugs in. And I was actually a big fan of that. So yeah, for me as an overall point, I don't get a lot out of that. I think it's a tricky thing to use because it is a serious thing. And Lindsay, I would 150,000,000% agree with that. I don't think that in our day and time, I think their original opinion on it, for people who maybe came into the show later or didn't hear the original interviews, Moffat and Gatiss had said that they were making him basically a recovering smoker and someone who had used in the past, but they had claimed that they had no interest in kind of pursuing that any further. And I thought that was a really wise decision. So,
well, if you're going to explore it in an actual, real, meaningful way, then fine. But like at this point, based on the episode we just watched, I think Robert Downey Jr.
Yes, exactly.
At this,
yes,
point, exactly, is doing a better, agree, job at dealing with addiction.
Yes. And on top of that, I mean, if you follow it through, he is on drugs because Mary Morstan told him
told
to
him
to go to hell.
Yeah.
And that's his interpretation, but it does not make sense because it's Sherlock Holmes. It's the smartest man on earth. He could fake it.
There's nothing about someone asking you to hurt yourself.
And you hurt yourself to a degree where you will die in a couple of weeks.
Kidney failure.
Yes.
There's nothing okay about asking somebody to hurt themselves to prove they love someone. And I will repeat that. There is nothing okay about asking someone to hurt themselves to prove they love someone. And that's not how John Watson and Sherlock Holmes work.
Well said. But that's always been a problem with Mary's character. It's something that has been coming up constantly at people who cross-examine her and break her down.
Absolutely.
As this character. Yeah. So she is problematic. She's incredibly selfish with a lot of her actions. And for her to tell Sherlock to hurt himself that badly just because she's like, oh, and that'll get him to save you. It's like, mate, really? That's your best freaking advice to give him?
Yeah.
Like, literally go.
No, it's just, it's
I prefer the other theory that people had going with the whole go to hell. They were thinking it was her trying to tell him to go to Norway. I much rather would have gone with that.
No.
Well, Norway's definitely better than a drug overdose.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I agree. I mean, much with
that version.
I mean, that was the point at which I began to be annoyed because I liked the case until we got to the revelation that there was more to this video and that it was, you've got to put yourself basically practically at death's door to cause this to happen. I would contend, however, that it's
attempt suicide to prove to someone that you care about them.
I would say, though, that this is a through line, not just with Mary's character. I would say this is a through line with the toxicity in John and Sherlock's relationship. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy Sherlock as a series, but this is something that has come up. The train scene would be an example.
Yeah. Yes. Yes,
we have John's reaction to Sherlock showing up in the empty hearse, which is played for laughs, but is also very violent. I mean, I'm not violent as well.
And like, there is no part of my body that is okay about watching John Watson beat up Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, like where do they get off on
there
that?
There is nothing about that.
Because all John is in this entire series is like violence.
His
hatred.
But there was nothing about watching that felt okay to me at all.
And not after John knows that Sherlock is like in seriously bad health. Like, and then kick him in the stomach. That is just that's just a
seriously,
mistake.
Seriously,
you're gonna
knee him again and again in the kidneys and you have kidney failure?
That's okay.
I think I'm not going to defend it like, ooh, I think that's awesome. I do understand it in the context of where they want us to believe that John Watson is emotionally in a self-loathing, in a very dark place. And again,
we knew
that.
John Watson is that man. Yes.
John Watson is not that person.
Yes.
It doesn't matter how fucked up John Watson gets. He's still not that person. That's not what's... I feel like one of the reasons that we love Sherlock Holmes and John Watson is because we know how much they care about each other. If you're going to take that relationship and deliberately make it ugly, I don't have to watch it anymore.
Right. I would say that is consistent to the John that we've seen in Sherlock. I'm not at all defending or arguing that that's the John that we see in the canon. Mm-hmm. I think that's a divergence of character quality. Yes. I think Martin Freeman has given us a very angry John Watson often. And again, I'm not at all defending that as who John Watson is in the canon. And I preferred it when... you know, his kind of friendship with Sherlock was an outlet rather than, you know, them being at odds. I mean, I think the biggest question here, and I largely agree with what you guys are saying, is how far you can pull a character out of shape before they break and they're not that character. Like, how far? Because I mean,
they're more that character fighting dinosaurs. At this point.
Right. And I mean, we had an affirmation in this episode. You know, many people I know from reading a lot of fan meta were hoping that, like, the late night texting and everything was maybe not what we were expecting. Well, we found out in this episode, regardless of what we found out about Holmes siblings and everything, we found out that from John's perspective, he actually was full on doing this. And that I found, and for me personally, I find that as disturbing and problematic as the issues with his relationship with Sherlock. They're kind of a piece to me, one and the same.
It's absolutely disturbing and problematic to cheat on someone.
Well, and it's just more, I love him.
The idea of John Watson, exactly. The idea of John Watson is of a decent person. Mm-hmm. That's his fundamental essence, is human decency.
Yes, and he does not need to grow into that, because he already is that person.
Right, he is that person.
Right?
That's a really good point.
They're breaking a character that they established to be a problematic person, which is acceptable, because you're all complex.
Absolutely.
But they broke him this time.
Well, and that decency is largely his function in the story, particularly in Sherlock. They set him up as, I'm the decent guy.
Exactly.
Well, and that's a problem anyway, because I think when you reverse that and you have ultimately Sherlock Holmes being the heart, we've had a mind and heart dichotomy, and that works. And suddenly we have Sherlock being, having to flip over. And I mean, I don't think throughout this series Sherlock has been as pulled out of character by any means. I think he has stayed closer to his general normal character. But I think, honestly, I think it was played beautifully. I think, the moment where they're kind of, making up or whatever. But the question there is, does it ring fully true if Sherlock Holmes is being the emotional intuitor in the situation?
Yeah.
And it's not that I don't think he has emotions. I agree with what they gave Mrs. Hudson when she says that he, she's the one that at that moment intuits that he's more emotional than, Mycroft is willing to admit or something like that. I have no problem with that.
That's all true, absolutely. I mean, the reason that Sherlock Holmes decides that he doesn't have emotions is because Sherlock Holmes experiences emotions on such a hardcore level that he can't actually deal with them.
Right. we've talked about the Vulcan-Spock kind of parallels there, the whole,
He has them.
Yes.
He just,
But it doesn't make it okay for him to be like, yes, he almost killed me, but he has every right to...
He has every
personally,
right to
like,
almost
kick
kill me.
My body with
his
foot.
Words. His word was, he is entitled.
Exactly. That's bullshit.
No one is entitled to kick you. No one is ever entitled to kick you. And I'm really triggered by this episode.
Speaking of triggers,
I am not okay about it.
There's a lot of triggers in this episode.
There's a lot of that as well. If we're going to go back to the canon. That character, most of the lines about her are based on the Veiled Daughter.
Right.
The Veiled Daughter, she has been mauled by a lion, and she has half a face. And it is one of the most strange, bizarre canonical cases. Because she essentially was attacked by this animal, and the reason that she wants to commit suicide is because she has essentially half her head. That's really dark. Already, how do you take that and then you try to turn it into something even darker? Do you need to do that?
That is a good point, and that is a really weird case. I was trying to, this is just a really random aside, but I was trying to help someone whose first language is not English, she's a professional translator, translate the Veiled Lodger, and they kept asking me questions just simply because they were getting the meaning, but it's just such a bizarre story. They were like, is this what this really means? And I'm like, yes, that's what it really means. So yeah, it was an odd story to choose to reference, I think.
Yeah.
Can we talk about how we did get a major prediction correct on the Baker Street Babes. We did predict a third sibling who is a sister.
We also said Sharonford is actually a girl's
name.
And I have a theory that the cliffhanger at the end of this is going to be, and this is, we can talk about what we loved and hated about the ending, but I feel like we're setting up the three Garadevs, right? Mm-hmm. Because the three Garadevs is
setting up the three Garadevs. Yeah, or they're setting up the double swift.
Yes, either way, it's either going to be the, I just killed you almost, forgive me, or it's going to be the, it was worth the wound thing.
Yeah.
So he's gonna need his cane again in a while.
So
yeah,
that's it, which is funny because that goes with the whole theme, that because some people are pointing out too that we're kind of making a cycle with them.
Yeah.
That yeah. all of this is like we're right back at the beginning, especially with the whole sister yeah. thing and all that.
Yeah.
Which is a bit, that was a bit much. I mean, I'm not gonna lie, at that part I literally shouted at the TV. Yeah. Sister.
And I were just sitting there shouting at the TV for most of it.
Yes. Yeah. also, can I just comment, because I was that was like one of the first things that Lindsay and me were talking about while we were watching the episode was John's drinking, and the fact that he does not feel that his daughter is safe with him, which is mm-hmm. also very fucked up. Very.
Well, yeah.
John Watson.
John himself knows though yeah. that he's wrong. He said that I'm not. Like, I'm not the good man that you're saying that I am, but I want to be. So it's like, is that them? Right. Is that them saying that, like, you know, we understand that John is, in our eyes, in all of our eyes, John is a good person. He's supposed to be the heart, the human side of Sherlock, kind of like, you know, the reflection of it. But people are full of flaws. That's what makes us human. But he's really, like, you're pushing it now. Like, you're
yes, and it gets to a point where it becomes unrealistic. Yeah, right. He wants to be a good person because he needs an outlet, and that is obviously a physical outlet, mm-hmm. and that is not good.
And also, I really hope that their solution to there being a baby in the picture is not, oh, she's with friends right now.
Yes,
and that just keeps going indefinitely.
Right, she just gets to live with Molly Hooper forever.
Yeah. Well, I guess,
I mean, that would probably be good for her.
I mean, we said this in the last reaction, which is like, why even introduce a child if that has no
bearing on any part of the situation?
Other than just, are they, you know, is it supposed to be emotionally manipulative? And like,
emotional manipulation.
I want to quote Hugh Laurie, as weird as this is, when he was asked about House a long time ago. He was asked about the difference between doing film and TV, and he said he felt like the primary difference when you have films and TV that works is that film characters cannot be static and TV characters must be static. And wow. I feel like this speaks to an issue, and I would say that part of why the Doyle canon works is that the Arthur Conan Doyle canon is like TV. It's 60 stories about two guys who have some very slow growth, but it's a growth trajectory that's very within the parameters of the characters as they've been written. You know, they have the consistent personalities, consistent virtues, etc., other than his continuity problems, but that's the other thing.
Those are funny.
Like, generally speaking, you know, we can read things between the lines if we want about, you know, womanizing or anything like that, but generally within the stories, we're not suddenly in the top of the ninth inning seeing Watson go off the rails.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is an issue when we're looking at Sherlock as a show. I think what we want often as viewers, and I would definitely agree with this, is to come and see these characters. Yeah, we want to see them confront challenges, but we want them to confront those challenges as consistent characters.
Mm-hmm. And come back to sit in front of the fireplace
exactly.
and get drunk and smoke a cigar.
Yeah,
exactly.
And then Holmes looks at a hat and talks about it for 10 minutes.
Yes.
And all the deductions are nonsense, but they're still just looking awesome. At a hat together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, we really want them just to look at hats together.
Like, I just want them back. And I'm kind of, and you guys mentioned it in this last episode too, about how it's gotten very James Bondy. And like, yeah. I almost agree with some commentary made that it's very special effects heavy, which, you know, is okay. I mean, I'm not gonna lie, I'm totally digging the Hudson thing. They can keep that.
But
the rest of it, I almost feels like a bit gratuitous at this point. Like, you guys need to, like, just because you got the budget doesn't mean you should do it. Like, you need to go back
exactly.
to simplicity. Simplicity, please.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all, I mean, I actually agree. It's funny because for me, I think it's that the things I liked outweighed the things I didn't, which seems to be the main disagreement I have with you guys, which is that your dislikes outweighed your likes. But I actually agree with most of what you guys are saying. The parts I like have to do with the more contained deductions that lead us to a mystery. And I would agree with you that there's like still a lot of extraneous. I think it's either Lindsay or Ashley said it on the last one that it's like, I think it was Lindsay who you said, you know, we knew after Tab, we were all concerned that they were going to just, like, dial it up from 11 to, like, 42. Like, mm-hmm. if Tab was dialed right. up to 11, and what mm-hmm. we wanted them to do was take it back to 10. And mm-hmm. it's still struggling. I mean, my relief, I think one of the sources of my positive reaction was the relief at the realization that we were going to get the Culverton-Smith story early on, and we were going to stay with it. Mm-hmm. We weren't going right. to end up somewhere. Like, I felt like with the last episode, I was so just discombobulated by, like, where we started, where we ended up. At least with this episode, I'm like, okay, I can see that we're progressing toward catching this guy. And I do want to put in that I think Toby Jones was like he's I great. Said before, I love him. So that's just a random thing
laugh.
For me.
That laugh
oh,
he did.
Oh, God.
It
awful.
Makes my skin crawl. I was like, ugh.
Yes, you did a good job at that.
Really, really good.
You know, did a funnily good job enough, though, like you're saying about the likes, the parts that I enjoyed so much is when it got back to the just simple, when he was doing the really cool deduction. I love that entire bit with the window and matching it and all.
Oh,
that.
Yeah, that was really nice.
When he was
doing
the simple stuff.
How eloquent almost and just, maybe I mean eloquent, but maybe I actually mean elegant.
You were going to say elephant.
In it's done in pink, just the serif, lowercase, white letters. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
They were really beautiful.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And there was something about that that was just, it was so simple, but it was so lovely. It was well executed. And there were things that happened again in this episode that were sort of like, okay, so now we're going to do letters, but with arrows.
Oh, yeah.
And it's going to be like amazingly 3D looking. And then like Sherlock's going to turn everything around in his mind. And it's going to be like, it, like you were saying, just because
oh,
you can
yeah.
do something.
That I mean, got on my nerves. The amount of like, I'm like, are we supposed to believe now that Sherlock is seeing the words? Because in the past, right. it was like, that represents for
he's
us.
Yes.
That like whole thing where he like the room is flipped around, nah.
And he's squishing
oh,
away
yeah,
the
that
chalk.
Bit. That bit got a little. That part got a little like, whoa, what's going on? I'm not gonna lie. At the beginning of this episode, there was a couple times where I genuinely zoned out and was just thinking about other things. And then I came back in and be like, oh, we're still in the, okay, we're still in the room. All right, he's still sweating. All right. It was really cool to see, like, taking away from, like, let's pretend this isn't Sherlock and it's actually some action-y crazy show. That was some really cool film work and all that stuff there. It's just my view of Sherlock has always been, it's a simple, I like simplicity because for me, simplicity, and this is even goes in design, it's the principle of design, that simplicity and not making things complicated tend to produce better product. And I think when they go back to the simple stuff, when we're going back to deductions, when we're going back to like just the normal stuff, as normal as Sherlock gets, it's so much better. That's why John and Sherlock, the whole where John finally, like a human being, expressed the pain that he was feeling and he broke down and he cried. And then Sherlock hugged him. Feelings. No, but beside that, I mean, like, it was a very human moment and very like, okay, so we're not...
Well, yeah. And that, I mean, ultimately, too, at the beginning of Sherlock, they said, we want to portray a Sherlock Holmes who's confident and who's, like, happy in who he is. And obviously, yeah. we've gone so, again, speaking to the fairly static versus not at all static character question, I think mm-hmm. as TV viewers, that's very enjoyable. I think most, I would venture to say most of the Sherlock fandom enjoys watching a Holmes and Watson having fun solving crimes. Mm-hmm. And once
they haven't been having fun solving crimes
right.
for two seasons now.
Because I would argue that that Holmes had agency in this story in terms of his own personal internalized plans.
Mm-hmm.
That the problem is that he is in such a place of self-loathing that he's doing a bunch of dumb stuff in between actually knowing what he needs to be doing. And mm-hmm. I think to me that doesn't, I like the confident Holmes, not that he has to be perfect or that he has to be unable to grow,
mm-hmm.
but that, you know, I love the sort of ongoing confidence of Mycroft. I'll say as a contrast, like Mycroft is not a perfect character.
No, I have questions about Mycroft too. Like,
and oh yeah.
because no, there's something that's been bothering me is that in Tab, he was like, oh, always be there for you. It made me stop because I'm an elder sibling. So absolutely, I could totally relate to him. Brother. But this last couple episodes, he's just been like the stone cold motherfucker. Like, I don't care. And he keeps saying it over and over. And I think the lady doth protest too much a bit because
I think he protests too much. I think he, you know, he thinks
to protest too much because otherwise there's no reason for him to be saying it over and over again. Otherwise, but there's still no reason for him to be saying it over and over again. That like emotional investment is one of the most important ways that you can reinforce character connections. Mm-hmm. And if you have a character who is perfectly positioned to have a large emotional investment in their sibling or their best fucking friend or their wife or any of those things, right? Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Oh boy.
And that thing also bothered me because, you know, we all know Mycroft and Goldfish, right? Mm-hmm. But this whole scene was just set up so he could pick up the fucking card and read, call Sharon Ford at 2 p.m. Like, no.
Right. A lot That's of it not... was very, like, what's the... I'm waiting for them. It's kind of like I'm waiting for them to get to the point already. Like, what are you getting at? You guys are, like, dilly-dallying and just, come on, just get on with it.
Yes.
Honestly, sir, I don't know if there is a point at this point.
I think I'm still hoping that they will redeem this.
Well, and this is... I feel like so much of what I've read, and you guys probably have too, is people saying... Oh, you shouldn't criticize, you know, you shouldn't, especially I heard it last week, you know, don't criticize it because it's all going to mean something. It's all going to this. And I go, first of all, I actually don't think that that's entirely true. And secondly, even if it was, at some point, you can't just say that episode, like, things need to work on their own to some degree. Like, I think, to go back to what we were saying, I think The Abominable Bride works on its own. I mean, I know there were complaints from people who had, like, never seen Sherlock, but I'm like, that kind of wasn't made for you anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, it works on its own because we, to some extent, we have a return to some of the joy and some of the sort of enjoyment of the two of them together as a partnership.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think for a lot of us, it's like these aren't the characters that we don't recognize them anymore. There's something almost completely new, which is why, though, on the same side, I'm trying to be as open-minded about it. I understand that they're not going to do the same thing that's been done over and over and over in other adaptations. I think they really are trying to create something that all is their own, and it's vaguely referencing Sherlock. As the stories that we know, but and again, that's why I jokingly say it, but I do mean it. I am holding out hope that something else will come from this. If it doesn't, in the grand scheme of things, if it doesn't, then for me, series 1 through 3 exist, and then 4 and onward are just like some strange psychotic dream.
And I would agree. I think, I mean, I've heard people say they're thinking, you know, post this series, it's possible that if they can't get the cast back for full series. If we get one-offs in which they do something that is a contained case, there is actually hope that one-off specials might deliver something better at this point.
Amy, you're an author. You just said something extremely apt. A contained case. Mm-hmm. It doesn't all have to have this ridiculous, gigantic...
Oh, I agree. I totally arc. Agree.
I mean, like some of it, sometimes you can do the solitary cyclist. Right. You know? And it can be about strangers in the countryside.
Mm-hmm. Please do that. Well, and my hope for a sibling, and I know it's Sherlock, so they were never going to do this, but if they were going to introduce a sibling, I would love for it have been to be just a straight-up family tragedy. Like, they lost a sibling, or, you know, there's a sibling in an institution somewhere, and maybe we have a visit with that sibling, because to me, at some point, Doyle draws on human, you know, pathos and misery for a lot of his emotional connections, right. And
that would have been the Nicholas Meyer explanation in the 7% solution of why Sherlock Holmes is this way.
Yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. And spoiler alert, but if you haven't read the 7% solution, or if you haven't seen the film, Holmes's mother was tragically murdered by his father, and if what you're trying to do is explain why Sherlock Holmes is like this and why he disconnects himself from most of the emotions that he's able to express on his own
and yet still has a great deal of empathy, then, okay, that's fine. That's interesting. But that the minute you do explain it,
I mean, the Sherlock version of that would be his father, who was the international man of mystery, murdered his, like, you know, CIA agent / the president's daughter. Like at some point.
Yes, exactly. But, like, also space aliens.
Right. And sharks.
Also flying fucking sharks.
I mean, to me, the best moments of that, which I think we're all saying, are either A, he's doing simple deductive process, or B, they're having a simple conversation. Mm-hmm. And I would include the conversation that Martin and Amanda had as John and Mary, where he's finally kind of, and I mean, that's a very TV convention. You have a full on, you know, other person's there kind of hallucination thing. Mm-hmm. I could live with it because I think the performances there ring true. Mm-hmm. But those are some of the simplest moments. And then again, I would also add when Toby Jones is kind of, when they're having their sort of final discussion. But again, that's a very closed, quiet, two characters interacting kind of moment. And at some point when we add aliens and explosions, we're taking away from the emotional connection. We're not adding stakes. We're actually, I mean, I said this in my print review of the last episode, which is that sometimes making a story bigger can make it feel smaller. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't work because the way that it's supposed to.
How is it less dramatic for John Watson not to be behind the bed?
Yeah. It would have been amazing. And because
more dramatic. And how is it better? In what way is the story better for John Watson not to be behind the bed?
And we did get the secret door in this room as well. So I would have really, really preferred the John Watson who, somehow, like that, the whole I'm calling Mycroft and I'm telling people, you know, things are going to happen, that it would have been in the past. And so, right, so then we have this cutting, this montage between those scenes in the hospital. And John in the car phoning and going there, which is obviously, you know, a Study in Pink reference, but that would have happened before this conversation in the room. So he could have been where Toby Jones came out of the wall, which I would have preferred muchly.
Canon moment to have Watson like pop out of behind the bed and be like, ha ha, I heard the confession. Like, that's an amazing moment.
I love that moment. This is my favorite part of The Dying Detective.
Yeah,
it's this realization.
Apart from the fact that Walter Pattinson illustrated it.
Right? Yes, that is true. But this whole moment of Watson understanding why things happened, right? And this is the thing. You have an emotional explanation for Mrs. Hudson came in tears to my flat and told me Sherlock is dying, all the way to, okay, this was a fucking terrible person and it was worth to suffer through this identity crisis of my friendship with Sherlock Holmes and walk out of this okay, right? Mm-hmm. And this is not what the story offered.
But do you think the casual viewer will notice that, though? Because they've often stated that the audience that they aim the show at is not just the canon lovers or those who are familiar with it. It is also aimed at those who are not. So I'm wondering, too, do you think that influences some of it, too? That they're... Apparently Sue is the one that they usually explain and tell her, here, take a look at this and what do you think about it? And whatnot. Obviously, they know, they're well aware of the canon. That's the part why sometimes I find it quite confusing. They know what they're doing, but it's at the same time it leaves me.
But that's what makes me sadder and madder.
Yeah, because if you know the entire ethos of it, and I really mean this, the ethos of it, if you know that it's about loyalty and love, and you get rid of that,
yeah,
right, and I agree with that. As a central problem. And I am seeing even more casual, not casual viewers of Sherlock, but those who are not as into other forms of Sherlock in media, who have specifically been complaining about the break in their relationship and the messing around with Watson's character. I think that's trickling down through, because people are going, look, even if I'm not familiar with the stories, I know they're about these two guys that are friends.
You can get it from the
Robert Downey Jr. films if you can't get it from BBC Sherlock. I promise you, you can watch Asylum Sherlock Holmes and it's still there. Right. You can watch The Great Mouse Detective.
Yes, preach it.
And in the, I would say in the canon story, he basically, their friendship earns Holmes the ability to do this thing to Watson that's actually quite horrible, but ultimately has a good cause. And that's earned by the fact that they're in a great place in their friendship.
Mm-hmm.
There's not been a break in their friendship. So when this happens,
and it's also pre-hiatus.
So when that happens, because he says, it's the second year of his marriage or something like that. So we can date it to then. But
it would have been 2 years after Sign 4.
Something like that. So early on, and it's it's Doyle, so who knows, but assuming if he means what he says there, that it's pretty early, if it's his first marriage, I guess it depends on where you want to put that. But in that case, you have two people who haven't had any kind of breach in their relationship. And I feel like Lindsay, I know it was triggering for other reasons too, but I feel like one of the most jarring things about having the moment where you have them violently, this violent altercation where he's punching him, is that the dying detective is essentially the opposite of that, because he is like, this is my best bud, we have no problem in our relationship, and I'm going to have to watch him die. And the opposite of this was kind of
literally the opposite.
Mm-hmm. And you kind of have Watson being like, I'd like to help him along, because I kind of want to come right now. And that's very much a subversion of where they are. I think I understand why they put it here, because they wanted to use it as a vehicle for reconciliation, but that's kind of the opposite of what we would hope or expect for
and
that.
And it's an abusive relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do we want to talk about the Irene Adler reference?
Oh, some people are saying that.
Can I just say that this episode was the most no homo episode of all the episodes? I mean, that was like J.K. Rowling, the cursed child, final scene, no homo level.
I know, how Mycroft?
You do not have to make Mycroft and Lady Smallwood a thing.
Yeah,
and you do not have, for Christ's sake, make Irene Adler and Sherlock Holmes a thing.
It's so extra. I was just like, this is so really extra.
Amy can do it, but not the BBC.
Only Amy can do
it. Amy's allowed. Yeah.
No, but I'm almost wondering.
No, thank you for that. But
do you think it really is? I don't think. I think John was just projecting. I don't actually.
Oh yes, absolutely. But you don't have to put that in the series. It is
the record. I don't actually ship Sherlock with anyone in this particular series, and I'm not saying that anyone can't or that no one has a right to, but
take one look at my Tumblr and I'll tell you where I'm
at. I have no everybody's free to ship whatever they want, but I just felt like and even if you do ship that hardcore, I feel like it was extra to this episode, and particularly Mycroft, do we need, I guess if it's setting something up for the next episode, I guess I can see why it popped up, but it didn't feel very organic. It didn't feel organic to anything that we have going on this series.
Random. And then they did the Mycroft bit, I'm like, okay, we're done here, please. And then of course they showed the exploding scene. I'm not gonna let that go, the exploding. It looks so fake too, I could Photoshop that better, come on.
Why are they on fire?
Right.
Why is it an Aerosmith music video?
Oh, right. Yep, we're diving into the alternate universe here.
Okay, I just died. That was the best. That's the winning line of this podcast.
Right. We're gonna make that. Okay. So, what do you guys think though about the fact that Eurus has come out, and now we know that is the East Wind story that Mycroft had been telling Sherlock since he was a young kid. And now it's all coming out. Ooh, the East Wind is coming. Ooh. So,
strange, because we've met the parents,
mm-hmm.
right?
And Sherford is, obviously we're going to get the backstory next time, but it doesn't, it's another inconsistency which does not make sense, and it will not, no matter what they do, it will not be explained away.
I agree. This is the thing to me, and again, it goes back to why I said I would have loved a restrained, even a family tragedy that was restrained, was realistic. Because how can we believe that these parents produced?
And I mean, wait, but there's nothing to say that is their biological sister. There's still so much that they could, I guess they can, remember, I'm trying to hold out hope, man. Just let me have and a faith.
Yeah, I mean, she's a great actress, that I will give.
Yeah.
I want to be at this level of optimism, where like, where you think that eventually it's going to make sense.
I keep because, hoping like, that they will.
I believe in you. Like, and if you think, and if you think eventually this is going to make sense,
I'm praying it might, at this point that
they it might change. Make sense.
Because right you know, now, the way they have all the not. Evidence laid out is they're basically going to play it out that Sharonford was the real Moriarty this entire
yes.
time. Honestly,
yes, exactly.
I thought
exactly.
she was going to be like, say, oh, Jim Moriarty, or whatever. She's going to be like, I'm the exactly. sister. I would have bought that sooner than this whole, like, I'm Sharonford.
Oh, because, yes.
They took care of that in Elementary in season
yes.
fucking...
I mean, they kind
when
of.
When Irene Adler and yeah. Jamie Moriarty were the
right.
same.
Right? But they also already, I mean, they hinted at it in season one, right? So what is Moriarty? It's like, it's not, it's so much more than a person.
Moriarty
so
is
they
not
kept,
more than a person.
No,
Moriarty
but like,
in
they,
the canon is
yes,
a dude
exactly.
that you see from a train station, and that is it.
Yes. a dark shape. in the distance. But I mean, they kept their options open for this one. So, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. But still, it's sort of, you know, it feels forced. It feels forced. And I'm kind of upset by it because we have so few episodes.
We have
Arthur
an episode.
Arthur wrote these stories for 60 years and he had inconsistencies because he also did a lot of other things. I'm sure the writers are sure look, I'm doing also a lot of other things. But if you have, like, what, 12 episodes to go back to, consistency can be a thing.
And I'm really, really hoping that we had this little redemption at the end. I'm going to pretend the fire explosion didn't happen. But I want to
I'm
see
sure
it.
This next
yeah, BBC is like, we got to make this bigger. How can we make a bigger
yeah.
explosion?
What's that? Dinosaurs. Oh, wait, we can't do that. Somebody already did that.
Sharks.
Yeah.
Sharks.
You know,
sharks.
To be honest, I was hoping that the whole Sharonford thing was a complete troll. I was hoping it was not going to be a third sibling. I was hoping that was going to mean something completely different. I've been hoping that this entire time.
I was hoping it was a code for something. Because when...
So do we... I'm sorry.
You know, like when we saw on Mycroft's fridge the number 13, I was like, oh, well, I remember Sherlock saying, you know, on top of the Bart's roof, he's like, there's 13 different ways it could have all gone. I was hoping, oh, that was one of the 13 options. And Sharonford is just him like, okay, go ahead and, you know, let's start that crazy plan or whatever. But no. Instead, it had to be, like, some probably crazy sibling that they're hiding away because she's probably... And, of course, it has to be a female because a female has to be the crazy one. Let me not even begin digging into that. All the
it's a wound.
She also faints occasionally because of the corset.
Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's like we got rid of CIA crazy assassin James Bond Mary, so now we have crazy, like, super criminal system.
Who's going after John Watson, writing...
Rest assured, that was not the part that I liked. You can rest assured.
also, do we know whether Michael Bay is directing?
Michael Bay might potentially be directing the next episode. I miss you the way Michael Bay misses the mark.
Oh, well done.
I need you back then.
See, even now, it's like wondering what show are we actually watching here? Because I did the rewatch like with everybody else because, you know, everyone was getting on the bandwagon. I'm like, let's rewatch it. And I went back. I'm like, wow, this is really good. And now it kept going and going. I'm like, wait, where am I? I'm gonna keep this. That's how this episode's gonna fade out with that singing. Just...
Yes, but yeah. you know what? Apart from the fact that we can just choose that we will just ignore this season, Matthias Boström has the best theory about this because for him, the Abominable Bride is the point where the story falls apart, and so there's parallel universes, right? Several layers, Inception-like layers, or completely disconnected Narnia-like layers, and this is one layer. So we can just, you know, we could just ignore it and write our own fan fiction and make it better.
Absolutely. Well, it's already being done anyways, but that is
exactly.
that does seem
that
to be
a
thing, though.
I mean, it helps to know that this is one version, and even within the same universe, right?
Well, it is fan fiction,
yes,
of something that we already quite like.
Mm-hmm.
So,
the show itself is already fan fiction.
It's worth repeating what you said last time, Lindsay, which is that if you are, like, for anyone who's bothered by the rift in the Holmes and Watson relationship or the violence or the sort of toxicity, there's an entire canon of 60 stories and many, many excellent further fan fiction and pastiche works that preserve those characters.
There's
and
loads of even just like fan-generated BBC Sherlock fan fiction that is brilliantly written that I'm like left there like, wow, my characterization, you nailed it. You need to write Moffat and Gatiss and be like, hire me.
And that's weird too when you look at fan fiction that was very in character for the early seasons and you realize that that fan fiction would now be out of character to these characters strange that is.
Yes.
Well, it's strange because I feel like the fan fiction that Moffat and Gatiss were writing in the first season was internally consistent with the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle universe to a certain extent, even though really a high-functioning sociopath is probably not the right way to describe Sherlock Holmes.
Hmm.
But still, I mean, to a certain extent, this was a story about two people who were very lost without each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what those stories are about. And you're absolutely right. You can go back and you can read any of the short stories. And if you don't feel like if you need a little more than a short story, read fucking Hound of the Baskervilles.
I think all in all, though, is like one thing we always have to remember, too. This is their interpretation of it. And there are so many other interpretations out there, pastiches, etc., that I don't always agree with. I think it's completely wrong, but that's my opinion.
Sure, and you could love them.
Yeah, and then there's other ones that I know I enjoy, and people are like, "Oh my god, you're trash!" I'm like, "Shut up, it's amazing." but you know, and that's fine. I think in the grand scheme of things, if people did love this episode, like we're not, like Amy had said last time too, we're not like shitting on you. We're not saying that you're
no
horrible
absolutely
for
not, and that's. That's a very good thing to say.
Yeah, it's like, if you did like it, if you do think that, no, we're wrong, that the characterization is right, that nothing, like, this stuff is fine, you guys just need to wait till the end, then fair game. I am truly waiting until the last episode before I'm going to give my verdict on the entire season as a whole, because I often find with this particular series, I need to watch everything before I can form a, like, positive, total, truthful opinion.
Right. And I mean, as I said, I think I still shake out to have the majority positive opinion here. And part of that is that I think there are just some amazing lines in the episode. Mm-hmm. One of the really memorable lines is when Sherlock says, in saving my life, she put a value on it. It is a currency I do not know how to spend.
Oh, that one got me.
That actually was quite quick.
And I think there were some classic Moffat lines sprinkled throughout.
Well, a lot of it, also, like, I felt the tune was the value of life was a big tune inside of here.
Also, Mrs. Hudson, John Watson, anything you ever want, ask me. Ask me.
Oh,
can I have a car?
God.
No. No.
Oh, my
everything,
word.
But not that.
Oh, you're just Stubbs all the way.
She embodied such sass. Like, that was just every- well... And no, and Mrs. Hudson too is very. I like that they've grown her. She's not just the lady who doesn't really talk. She's not the housekeeper. She's so much more. And I guess on some level too, she was like telling them like, yeah, she's basically saying like what the rest of us are saying, like, you guys need to make up already and like get on with it. Even Mary was trying to tell them to do that.
Would that have been amazing if that was what would have happened?
Sorry, but I feel like you're writing these episodes better.
I'm trying to be optimistic, man. No, it's because I do. I truly love this series. I love it so, so much. So, obviously, I get very disappointed when, particularly John, and we've said this over and over, and I'm not going to rehash it too much, but, like, John just severely disappointed me. Like, trash can. He turned him into a trash can. He's a fucking dumpster. Forget trash can. He's a dumpster of just...
How many times did he fall in the bins?
Seriously, not enough times, because clearly it took him a while to get a sense, but there are redeeming qualities about it. That line, I particularly like the line, which is your own death is something that happens to everybody else. Your life is not your own, so keep your hand off of it. And I loved it. There's little bits and pieces like that that I enjoyed. And as always, I find that these series, I know the metas kind of get a bit crazy and they get a little bit out there, but I love the thrill of just, let's go through all of this and try to find the symbolism. And even if it turns out to not all be true, I don't care. I still enjoyed the game of going through it. Oh, did you catch the canon hint here? Did you guys know where that comes from? And then what I do enjoy too is that by people searching through the meta and trying to decode and understand everything, they are actually starting to go towards the canon and read it themselves, which is always a good thing because it keeps everything going and alive.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you too?